Chapter 34 Kitty. Kitty located the prisoners far faster than she had expected. The slowest part was at the outset, as she geared herself up to leave the little room. When she first stood, every muscle in her body protested to the skies. She shuddered as if from extreme cold. Her head felt light and watery, but she did not capsize. "I've just got to relearn it," she thought. "Remind my body what it can do." And it was true that with each shuffling step her confidence grew. She made it to the cache of weapons piled beside the door. She grimaced, bent her knees, crouched and held that position, wobbling and cursing as she rummaged through the pile. Jolt sticks, inferno sticks, elemental spheres, familiar objects from the resistance years. She had no bag, but tucked an inferno and a jolt stick in her belt. Two spheres, with difficulty, fitted in the tattered pockets of her jacket. She removed Ptolemy's Apocrypha, and set it, not without a certain reverence, on the floor. It had served its purpose well. Among the magical objects lay a silver disc, smooth and razor-edged. Subduing a slight, unaccountable aversion, she added it to a pocket. Then, supporting herself against the wall, she clawed herself back to her feet. Carefully, little by little, she set off out of the room, over the shattered fragments of the door, down the corridor, past the bleak expanse of the ruined hall of statues. She had a memory in her mind of plaintive sounds coming from behind a door close to where Nathaniel and she had been imprisoned. As she went, Kitty was conscious of a strange division within her. Never had she felt so appallingly weak, so tentatively tied to earthly strength. Yet by the same token, neither had she ever felt so wholly sure of herself as she did now. Often in the past she had been filled with reckless certainty, with joyful confidence in her youth and vigour. This was not like that. It was a calmer feeling, quieter, entirely unconnected with physical things, and lacking the edginess they tended to involve. It was a kind of implacable assurance. She felt it radiate from her as she shuffled along. Her first test did not dent this feeling in the slightest. At the point where the corridor broadened out, close to a set of stairs, Kitty encountered one of the demons. Probably it was the last to take possession of a body. Certainly it had not mastered it with any great success. Its host had been a tall, thin man with blonde and lanky hair, dressed in dark clothes of obvious expense. Now the clothes were ripped and torn, the hair disordered, the eyes opaque like sea glass. The legs stumbled from one side of the corridor to the other, the arms thrashing blindly. A feral growling issued from his throat, and with every now and then angry words in an unknown language. The head turned. It caught sight of Kitty. A yellow gleam burned behind the eyes. Kitty halted, waiting. The demon's interest showed itself in a sudden, wild ululation that set the glass rattling in the cabinets along the corridor. It decided to attack, but seemed in doubt exactly how to issue a magical bombardment. First it raised a leg, pointed a foot, and blew its own shoe off. Next it tried an elbow, with comparable success. Lastly, with painful hesitation, a hand was raised, a trembling finger extended, and a bolt of lilac light was delivered forth to strike the amulet of Samarkand and be at once absorbed. The demon inspected its finger in annoyance. Kitty took the jolt stick from her belt, stepped quietly forward, and sent a burst of shimmering blue current rattling through its body. Swathed in black smoke, the demon jittered, jigged, flung itself backward, crashed through the balustrade, and fell 4 meters to the steps below. Kitty went her way. Minutes later, she came to the door she had remembered. Listening closely, Kitty detected muffled groans. She tried the door, found it locked, and blew it open with the first of her elemental spheres. Once the final winds had died away, she stepped inside. The room was not large, and what space it had was blotted out by recumbent bodies. At first sight, Kitty feared the worst. Then she saw that all were neatly tied and gagged, just as they had been left by Makepeace's imps so many hours before. Most were secured by the minimum of ropes and cords, but one or two were swathed in sheets or thick wads of black netting. There were perhaps 20 individuals in the room, sardine-packed, head to toe. To Kitty's great relief, she saw that many of them were moving, with sad little wriggles, like maggots in a jar. One or two pairs of staring eyes caught sight of her. Their owners writhed and uttered pleading moans. She took a moment to gather herself. Her legs shook with the effort of her stroll thus far. Then she spoke as clearly as she could. "I'm here to help you," she said. "Wait as patiently as you can. I'll try to cut you free." This pronouncement induced a remarkable flurry of squirms and wails. Legs thrashed, heads bucked and twisted. Kitty was nearly knocked over by the flailing of the bodies next to her. "If you don't lie quiet," she said severely, "I'll leave you." Instant quietness among the prone magicians. "That's better. Now then." With clumsy fingers, she took the silver disc from her pocket, and holding it carefully so as not to slice her fingers, set to upon the nearest bonds. The cords parted like butter to a hot knife. Cramped hands and feet moved tentatively, their owner emitting cries of pain. Without ceremony, Kitty removed the gag. "When you can stand," she said, "find something sharp and help me untie the others." She moved on to the next magician. Within 10 minutes, the room was filled with limping, stretching men and women, some sitting, others standing first on one foot, then on the other, trying to wring the pins and needles from their numb and swollen limbs. There was no conversation. The bodies had been freed, but the minds remained wrapped in shock and disbelief. Kitty worked silently on the penultimate captive, a large gentleman swathed in netting. He seemed inert. Blood had seeped through the cloth around his head. Beside her, the first person she had freed, a young woman with mousy hair, struggled with the cords of the last magician. This one, covered in a coarse grey blanket, was very much alive. Her legs kicked back and forth with furious impatience. Kitty passed the silver disc across. "Here. Thanks." In moments, the swathes of net and blanket had been removed, and the two captives lay revealed. One, a woman with long dark hair, hanging over a red and puffy face, sprang instantly to her feet and shrieked with agony as her cramp kicked in. The other, an immense old man with a badly beaten face, lay still. His eyes were closed. His breathing came in ragged gasps. The dark-haired woman leaned back against a wall and massaged a leg. She gave a snarl of pain and fury.
Who is responsible for this? I'll kill them, I swear it."
Kitty was busy talking to the woman with mousy hair.
"He's in a bad way. Someone needs to get him to a hospital."
"I'll fix it," the woman said.
She looked around the room, picked out a spotty youth.
"George, can you oblige?"
"All right, Miss Piper."
"Wait."
This was Kitty. Wearily, she tried to rise, extended a shaking hand.
"Can you help me up, please?"
"Thanks."
She turned to face the room. "You all need to know what's happened. The situation outside may be difficult. Demons have broken loose in London." Gasps. Oaths. The assembled faces registered sagging dismay. Young and old, they gaped at her, vulnerable and uncomprehending. Gone was any vestige of magicianly assurance. Now they were nothing but humans, panic-stricken, leaderless, stripped bare. Kitty held up a hand.
"Listen," she said, "and I'll tell you."
"One moment!"
The black-haired woman reached out and clutched at Kitty's arm.
"First, who the hell are you? I don't recognize your face. Or," she curled a lip, "your dirty little clothes. I don't think you're even a magician."
"Correct," Kitty snapped. "I'm a commoner, but you'd do well to shut up and hear me out if you want to avoid being killed."
The woman's eyes widened.
"How dare you?"
"Yes, shut your trap, Farah," a man said.
The woman seemed to choke. She looked around wildly, but let go of Kitty's arm. This one exception apart, everyone in the room seemed eager, grateful even, to listen to what Kitty had to say. Whether it was their residual shock that kept them quiet, or whether they glimpsed in the grey-haired girl with the lined and weary face something that commanded unequivocal respect, was hard to say.
But they listened with complete attention as Kitty told them what had happened.
"What about the rest of us?"
one of the elder men said plaintively.
"There were 100 at least sitting in that theatre. Surely they haven't all."
"I'm not sure," Kitty said. "Perhaps there are other rooms of prisoners that the demons forgot, or decided to ignore. You'll have to see. But many of you are dead."
"What about Mr. Devereux?"
a woman whispered.
"Or Jessica Whitwell, or—"
Kitty held up her hand. "I'm sorry, but I don't know. I think it likely that many of the most senior magicians have been possessed or killed."
"This one hasn't," the dark-haired woman spoke savagely. "Until they are found, I am the sole council member remaining, so I am now in charge. We must get to our pentacles and conjure our slaves. I shall contact my police wolves forthwith. The renegade demons will be found and destroyed."
"Two things," Kitty said quietly. "No, three. This man must be seen to first. Can anyone provide transport?"
"I can."
The spotty youth bent beside the limp body.
"Going to need three of us for this. Mr. Johnson, Mr. Vole, can you lend a hand? Help me get into a limo."
Assistance came. The men departed, supporting the invalid between them. A clap of the hands, the dark-haired woman was by the door.
"To the pentacles," she commanded. "No time to waste."
Nobody moved.
"I think this lady had something more to say,"
an older man said, nodding toward Kitty.
"We should hear her out, don't you think, Miss Farrer? Out of courtesy, if nothing else."
Miss Farrer's lips twisted.
"But she's nothing but a—"
"I had 2 further points to make," Kitty said.
She felt very tired now, light-headed. She needed to sit down. "No. Get a grip. Get the job done. The chief demon, Nauda, is very terrible. It would be suicide for you to approach him without the greatest possible weapon, and that is already being done."
She looked around the silent group. "A magician, another surviving council member," Kitty could not resist a sly glance at Ms. Farrer here, "has gone to meet it. He uses Gladstone's staff."
She was only half surprised by the stifled exclamations of astonishment. Ms. Farrer, in particular, seemed incensed.
"But Mr. Devereux has forbidden it," she cried. "Who would dare to—"
Kitty smiled.
"It is Nath, John Mandrake. You had better hope he is successful."
"Mandrake?"
Farrer's face was pale with fury.
"He doesn't have the talent."
"The final thing I would like to say," Kitty went on remorselessly, "is that with this being so, the most important thing for us, for you, I should say, you are the magicians, you have the power, is to provide protection and guidance for the people. Since Makepeace imprisoned you all, there has been no leadership, no one to evacuate areas where the demons are at large. We risk mass casualties here, mass casualties. If we do not act, many commoners will die."
"Never bothered us before," a young man muttered at the back, but general opinion was against him.
"What we need is a crystal," Piper said. "See where the demons are."
"Or a scrying bowl. Where do they keep them in this place?"
"Must be one. Come on."
"Let's get to the pentacles. I could summon an imp, send him off. We'll need more cars. Who here can drive?" "I can't. My man does that."
"Nor me."
At the door, a harsh, forced cough. Ms. Farrow's face was haggard, her hair tangled and dishevelled, her mouth a thin-lipped slash. White hands pressed hard against the doorframe on either side. Her arms were bent, her shoulders slightly hunched. The posture gave her a faint resemblance to an inverted bat. Her gaze spat venom.
"Not one of you," she said, "is anything better than a junior minister. Most of you are scarcely even that. Just secretaries and desk-hands. Your knowledge of magic is painfully limited. Your judgment, it seems, is even worse. The commoners will look after themselves. Some have resilience. No doubt they can repel a few detonations. There are, in any case, many of them. We can afford to lose a few. What we cannot do is stand around dithering while our capital is under attack. What, we're going to leave it up to Mandrake? How good a magician do you think he is? I'm going for my wolves. Anyone with any remaining ambition will follow me."
She pushed herself back from the door frame, and without a backward glance, set off down the corridor. Uneasy silence. After a pause, three of the young men, heads lowered, brows scowling, pushed their way past Kitty and departed. Several others wavered, but remained. The young woman with mousy hair shrugged. She turned to Kitty.
"We're following you, Miss—" "Sorry, what is your name?"
"Clara Bell? Lizzie Temple?"
"Kitty Jones," she said.
Then, more faintly,
"Can anyone get me something to drink?"
While Kitty rested, while she sipped cool mineral water from the council's own supply of bottles, the junior magician set about their work. Some ventured around the Whitehall chambers. They returned, trembling and wan, with reports of bodies piled inside rooms, of pentacles slashed and ruptured, of such devastation as none had ever dreamed. Carnage like this was generally visited on enemies at a distance. It was troubling for the magicians to experience it first-hand. Others crept to the front of the building and peered forth into Whitehall. Buildings were on fire. Corpses lay in full view. What was most unsettling was the utter absence of the people. Ordinarily, even in the small hours, buses and taxis continued to pass that way, together with the comings and goings of night staff in the ministries and patrols of police and soldiers. The machinery of government, beheaded by the treachery of Makepeace and surprised by the appearance of Nauder, had for the moment ceased altogether. The destruction of the pentacles was a setback, but it soon became clear that the ferocity of the demons exceeded their efficiency, and here and there circles were found that had been overlooked and spared. A few small imps set forth on reconnaissance. Meanwhile, in a chamber close to the Hall of Statues, a giant crystal ball, formerly employed by the council, was located and brought to the room where Kitty sat. The magicians congregated, hushed and sombre. Without preamble, the strongest individual present, a junior minister from the fisheries, summoned the jinni trapped within the ball. In ringing tones it was directed to its task, to reveal the position of the renegade demons. The ball went smoky, dark. Everyone leaned closer. Lights within the crystal. Red and orange, leaping flames. The focus cleared. Raging fires near and far. Lanterns among dark trees. In the distance, a giant, hump-backed glow of light.
"The Glass Palace," someone said. "That's St. James's Park."
The commoners were demonstrating there.
"Look!"
In the foreground, hundreds of running forms, wheeling, scattering like fish shoals through the trees.
"Why don't they get out?" "Surrounded!"
Here and there, bursts of magic, corralling the panic-stricken crowds, redirecting them back upon themselves. Glimpses of unnatural movement on the margins, great bounds and leaps, sudden rushes. Hopping, prancing figures, human in their shape, inhuman in their gleeful capering, active on all sides. One loped into clear view beneath a lantern. It spied a cluster of men and women fleeing in its direction. It bent its back, prepared to spring. A shaft of white light, a tremendous explosion. The loping creature vanished, in its place a smoking crater. A figure passed beneath the lantern out of sight, going with steady strides. It held a long staff in its hand. Kitty placed her mineral water carefully on the floor.
"Summon whatever demons you can," she said. "If we're going to do any good at all, that's where we have to be."